The EMS Garage is a production of EMSRadio.com. You can find us on Facebook, just search EMS Garage. You can find us on Twitter at EMS Garage. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com, or call us, 303-720-6001.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Bell 922 is on scene.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. It's your weekly podcast about all things EMS and everything in between. I'm your host, Chris Montero, the geeky medic on all the websites, as you've probably heard me say a billion times, so I won't go into it. I am really happy this week. We have, again, the industry experts always love to come and join us, and this week I have three brand new guest hosts, as well as two that are returning, and I always love it when people want to come on the podcast and talk about EMS, because then I learn that I'm not such an EMS geek after all, that actually there are people out there that like to talk about this in their off time, because I am off right now, well, maybe always, but no, okay, maybe a few more than not always, but hey, and we also are trying to get to go to EMS Expo this year, and we need your support. If you think you want us to go to EMS Expo, write us and tell us. Tell us, A, that you want to go, and the reason you want to go is because you want to see Chris Montero, Kyle David Bates, and you want to see Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and Ted Settler, and you want us to be there doing our live shows from the floor. Because we just need a little extra push to get there, and we are looking for a sponsor, and I think that those well-received words would be pretty happy. So send them to me, emsgarage@gmail.com, and I will include those in our packet of information of people that want us to go. You know what was really cool is this past week I got to chat with two high school students, both of which listen to the EMS Garage, and they love it. They said, you know, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do after high school, but I think because of you guys, I'm going to go into this field. Maybe it wasn't because of us, I don't know, or maybe they're just as nerdy as me. I don't know yet, but I'm actually really happy that this medium can reach out to people and help them with their future careers. And I'm very excited about that. So, joining me first is a newcomer, Dr. Jeff Myers. Hello, sir.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Where are you from? And, you know, who are you? And how did you get on this thing? And, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself.
It's all Kyle's fault.
Well, almost all. Everything is.
We'll just blame it. Blame me.
Blame me. I'm used to it.
I'm an emergency physician, EMS physician in Buffalo, New York, working at Erie County Medical Center, which is our regional trauma center here in Buffalo. I've been here since 2001, did my residency here in EMS fellowship and stayed on. I guess they liked me enough that they kept me around. But my niche is education, and just moved into a position as the director of the simulation center here at the University of Buffalo. I've got about 23 years in EMS, from EMT on up to a medic and educator and some administrative type stuff, and way too many letters to even think about. So that's a bit of my background.
Very cool, and glad to have you, and glad that Kyle, even though it's Kyle's fault, we're glad to have you anyway. Because, you know, he's generally a good guy, so we like that. Well, thanks for coming on. Also joining us for the first time on our podcast, but she's been on other podcasts on the EMS Garage Network, or EMS Radio Network. Oh, sorry, Kyle. Didn't mean to take over your... it's pick on Kyle Knight, apparently.
I'm used to it. Go for it.
Wilma Vinton from Alaska. Hello. Tell us a little bit about who you are and where you're from.
I'm from Fairbanks. I'm up in the center of the state. I have been in EMS for over 30 years. I started out actually teaching CPR and advanced first aid when advanced first aid was the minimum level for ambulance services in Montana. And then we moved to Alaska in 83, actually. And I was I'd gotten my EMT in 79 and continued with EMS. I have spent most of my career as a volunteer. There was a short period of time that I actually responded and was getting paid as a responder for an air ambulance service, about 8 years. But other than that, I'm predominantly been a volunteer. I am definitely have EMS in my blood. In real life, I'm an accountant. That's what I do get paid for, but I also now teach advanced classes. My job description actually says 50% accountant, 50% teacher, which is kind of fun. But I teach on the teaching side. I teach the advanced classes for the regional area that we are in, which is EMT2s and 3s and paramedics. Been around a while. Seen lots of changes. When I first in one of the classes, I got introduced as someone who not only has was there for the white papers, but actually read them. It's kind of scary.
I have a copy of it. You can get a copy through the government.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, you can. But I actually, you know, I was there when we first started EMTs in Montana. The way they got EMTs on the ambulances was by giving them a carrot of we'll buy you an ambulance if you will put an EMT on it. So I was part of that whole process. Long time ago.
I think we've all kind of been here a while. I've been in EMS 20 years, so I know how it feels. I don't feel old, but at other times I do. And I feel older when people younger than the number of years I've been in EMS are now starting, and it's kind of scary. So yeah, anyway, thanks for joining us tonight, and I really appreciate it. And one question for you though: would you do accounting if you had to do it for free?
No.
Okay.
That's the fight. Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, I'm definitely a medic at heart. But you know, back in the day, there wasn't a lot of opportunities to earn money as an EMT. So, and then I sort of got into that process and went a different route as far as how I make my living.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the conundrum we all get into. At some point, we have to decide what we want to do for a career. And sometimes it works out right, and sometimes you just get to dabble in the EMS and do make yourselves a livelihood somewhere else. So, well, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it. Final new guest tonight, Mr. James Warmuth. He a little bit of background. He emailed me a couple weeks ago and said, "Hey, I want to get into this podcasting gig," and I said, "Come on board. We'd love to have you and love to bring you on, and you can see what it's all about." Maybe he wants to host a new show on the EMS Radio Network, so that could be kind of fun. But we'll break him in easy and let him go. So, James, tell us who you are and where you're from and what you do.
Well, I'll tell you, after listening to the other people, I'm kind of the young runt on the deal here. I've got about 8 years in EMS. I mostly work for private transfer services in Victoria, Texas. Also, I teach at the local college and also do some stuff with technology and things like that. I'm the technology director of my company, and I don't have much of a life outside of that, to be honest.
All right. Well, thank you. And you also do mainly non-911 interfacility transfer work. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Right on. Well, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it, and I promise we'll go easy on you the first week. But then after that, it's fair game, just to warn you.
Fair enough.
All right. Also joining me tonight, hopefully not inner hip waiters from All the Oil, Miss Natalie Quibido.
Hello.
Hello. And Jeremedic, is he there as well?
Yes, hold on one second. Jer, come say hi. He's coming.
Should we ask? Is that a Twitter romance burgeoning? Hello. Is that a Twitter romance we could talk about? Twitmans?
No, it's not.
Okay, we won't talk about it.
Okay, but yes, he is here with me in sunny Louisiana.
Very cool. Louisiana. Hey, I'm getting some feedback from you, Natalie. There we go. Yeah, you might want to turn it down just a little. Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Also, Mr. Sean Eddy. Hello, sir.
How are you?
I'm good. How have you been?
I've never been better.
Right on. And I hope your summer's going well.
Yeah, it's pretty hot. Kind of hoping to escape the heat pretty soon here, but overall it's good.
Right on. Well, thanks for joining us. And last but never least, Mr. Kyle David Bates.
How are you doing, Chris?
Good. And I promise not to pick on you much more tonight.
Yeah, like 2 or 3 more minutes, right?
Well, we've got what? How many more minutes we got in this podcast? Exactly. I promise not more than 50 or 60, so we're fine.
Right.
Well, thank you all for joining us tonight. So what I want to talk about first is there was an article this past week on EMS1.com. It got picked up on many of the news sites, as well as I think Gems picked it up as well. Response time, still the holy grail. And it's an article written by Art, and I hesitate to pronounce his last name because it's Asian, and I will definitely mess it up. Anyway, Art says, he's responding to the Lee County, Florida agency that spent about $500,000 on prediction EMS call prediction software. And we talked about this, oh goodness, if you rewind EMS Garage about episode 40s or 50s, you'll find it in there, and it's called Predicting the Future. And that podcast really dealt with this idea of how do we predict where the next EMS call is going to happen. And so they've spent a lot of time in this new, it's brand new technology. I mean, it seems like it would be pretty simple, but there's a lot of complicated algorithms. Anyway, I guess the beef is a lot of the paramedics down there are like, yeah, this is kind of inefficient. I read an article when we were researching tonight's topic, and one of the medics said that they would go out and sit and post for 5 hours while the entire rest of the system was busy waiting for that next call in this one zone that was inevitably going to happen. And, you know, is it a product that's well ahead of its time, or is it all pseudoscience and bunk? Now, discuss. Okay, nobody cares.
I think, first of all, they need to post all the ambulances right near the nursing homes right when they're about to get off duty, because that's where the calls seem to come out. But other than that, I'm not sure that you could predict where the calls are going to be.
True. Kyle?
You know, I've always found that it's almost impossible to predict human behavior, even with a highly complex computer algorithm. People are going to do strange and unusual things regardless, and where you think they're going to call, they're usually not going to.
Right, but I think the idea behind the software, and I'm not defending it by any means, but I think the idea behind the software is to pick certain zones in the city, and based on previous history, what they do is plug in all of the calls that have happened over a historic period of time. And we all know this historically, just like you said, Sean. You know, posting the ambulances by the nursing homes right as you're getting ready to go off duty. Maybe that's a good indicator. I don't know, but that idea of taking historical data and applying it to something in the future is nothing new. I mean, they do that in statistic modeling all the time. And maybe it's just
is you have the underlying assumption that people are going to do the same things. They're going to travel in the same patterns. They're going to be at work at the same times. They're going to be at home at the same times. You know, statistical modeling, like you said, has been used in industry quite a bit for manufacturing to keep things in tolerance. But talking about very repeatable processes, and I'm not sure that our world's behaviors are very repeatable.
Right, but I would hesitate to say that Kyle knows with some certainty, I would hesitate to say most paramedics know with some certainty, that today they have a higher probability of getting a call in one place over another just because of their history with the system. Because they would go, okay, well, it's lunchtime and nobody's in the suburbs at this time of day, so I think our likelihood of getting a call down near where all the office complexes are is probably higher than not. Just because, but, and you're right, we can't predict people's behavior. And I don't think that's what this was about. It's predicting where calls have trended over time and having a resource there to answer it quicker.
It looks like this is more along the lines of, you know, the next call will show up at this location. And, you know, I mean, you go back to system status management, one of the key parts of it is you know, unit utilization, figuring out where to staff your units based on, you know, looking at where calls come in at, you know, days of the week and hours. And that's, I mean, that's just the foundation of that. But, you know, I'll do that for $250,000. But for $500,000, you know, I got an issue with, you know, one, with the cost. You know, are they really saving that much money? You know, what is their change in the response times from that? And are they getting, you know, proper unit utilization?
They claim they are. And according to what the assistant chief or what, I can't remember what her title was when she was interviewed. And of course she was in a newsroom style interview. And she said, of course we've saved money and we will save more money over the long haul. I don't even know.
She has to say that.
Well, of course, her butt's on the line for $500,000. I would say whatever it took. But maybe the bigger question is, and maybe we should be talking about this more in general, what the article talks about is response times. Really, are they something that we really need to worry about? If we think about cardiac arrests, I think, and where our industry standard for 8 minutes and 59 seconds 90% of the time came from, is this idea that people's hearts and brains start dying at that, you know, the ability to get them back after a heart attack drops precipitously at that point. Mainly at 6 minutes, really. So if we're going to build the perfect EMS system and draw circles around an ambulance and make sure that everybody throughout the country would be no less than 6 minutes away, well, that's just not practical. So should we build a system, and maybe that's the bigger question, should we build a system based on, I hesitate to say, less than 1% of our volume, sudden cardiac arrest? Or should we build a system on providing good customer care and responding appropriately and quickly, but maybe not always within that 6 minutes? We've built a false expectation in the public that 6 minutes is the right time for everything. Now, nobody wants to be laying in a ditch for 20 minutes while you're waiting for the ambulance. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that. But this idea that we have built this inappropriate response time standard, maybe we need to start thinking about that as people in the industry and as people that are up and coming, and I talk about everybody here, no matter how many years of in EMS, you have at least an idea of what I'm talking about.
I think I would want to know, the article talks about, you know, response time and trying to develop a way to put the ambulances in the places that they need to be in any given time. Is it because they want to get them there for that response time, or they want to get them there for that those cases when time is paramount, you know, is of a concern? Because that the software itself, if it's just where you should place your ambulances, you could do it with cheaper software with algorithms. Or is it, are we placing it so that I can get there within the golden hour, I can get there within that 8 minutes for those calls that I know are going to happen that are really bad? There's two issues there.
Good point. Very good point.
I think that they're probably, not knowing what kind of system they were running before, when they say that it's going to cost them $500,000 to implement the system. Well, if they had no system before, no GPS or no computer-aided dispatch or any of that, then yeah, it could cost them a ton of money to implement this. But if they already had a system status plan in place, then, you know, it might not have cost them as much. So I think they're probably looking at saves money, but they're also just trying to follow the masses. I mean, around my area, we use system status, and whereas the fire department, they've got a fire station for every so many blocks. Well, we can't afford to do that. You know, running a private ambulance service, we just can't afford to do that. So we implemented system status to save money to keep the units on the road. So I guess in a sense, they wouldn't have to have as many ambulances on the road if they were following the masses of people. If it's 5 o'clock, you can pretty much guess that you're going to get a lot of calls around the highways. On the weekends, you're probably going to get a lot of calls at houses. On nights, you know, most of your calls are probably going to come from residential areas. So, I don't necessarily think it's a bad idea, but, I kind of have to agree that you can't really predict where the calls are going to come out, but, you know, I don't know. I think it's a good system.
I'm not sure you need a $500,000 piece of software or even $250,000 piece of software to really figure that out. I think if you get somebody who within the organization is fairly bright and there's a lot less expensive geomapping programs, that you probably can look at it from a global standpoint in clusters and zone off your area, your response area, to try to follow the masses without getting tied down the minutia, which, I mean, again, we're taking an article and not seeing both sides of the story, but it looks like they're getting tied down in the minutia.
You know, I actually agree with that, and I think a good system status committee or a just taking the human element and saying, hey, you know, do a study over a 6-month period and say, statistically speaking, you know, during nighttime hours, we run most of our calls around the residential areas. So at, let's say, 7 o'clock, you start, you know, you alter your posting plan, or on the weekends, you alter your posting plan, or holiday weekends, you try and stay closer to the highways, or, during the day, stay around the commercial and the industrial areas. I think that's a great idea, and you're right. It wouldn't take much money to do that, if any.
It's kind of interesting when you mentioned or had the first question that led into this discussion about it, what response time really is the right response time. Are we, what do we use as our measure for how fast we want to get our ambulances there? And really, it depends on how much society wants to pay for that. You know, do they want to pay for a 6-minute response time? Do they want to pay for an 8-minute response time? Do they find that it's okay and acceptable to pay for a 15-minute response time? I'm not sure that from an outcome standpoint, it really matters, except in a very few call situations. And especially in today's limited healthcare dollars, you really start to think about how we can best manage the system and not waste resources, as was mentioned about using the system status management to keep the units on the road.
Now, I worked in a lot of different systems. I worked in urban systems, high volume suburban systems, rural systems, such as when I was up in Maine. I mean, I drive 45 minutes to intercept with a BLS truck that's been on the road for 45 minutes with a cardiac arrest. And I got to tell you, since I've been here in the Tonawanda, in my 20 years of EMS, never have I been involved in so many cardiac arrest saves. I'm talking saves, like walking out of a hospital saves, or known of an area that has so many, you know, of them. With that, and I'd like to say one thing is we, you know, we have a police officer with AED and CPR training on a team within 2-3 minutes. Where we're up in Maine, you're going 45 minutes, and I'm sure Alaska, Wilma, is similar to that as well. And I mean, the chances of someone being saved in that situation is probably very, you know, minimal. And like Jeff, you're saying, how much you're going to pay? Are you going to pay for an ambulance to sit in your area?
You know, in that case, it may be more cost effective to say, well, we really don't have the ability to change the cardiac arrest outcome. Maybe we should figure out how to put our healthcare treatment dollars into some other disease entity or condition or situation that we can affect. You know, if we're in an extremely rural area or extremely urban area.
You know, as long as we keep using this, and I hate to call it this, but our cookie cutter EMD systems. I mean, you know, we got dispatchers reading off of a card, and they ask questions that can typically guide someone into saying, you know, yeah, I'm having difficulty breathing. Someone calls in because they've got a boil on their foot, and the dispatcher asks, well, are you changing colors? Are you having difficulty breathing? Well, yeah, I am. Okay, well, then they get a priority one response, lights and sirens, and that person's put in the same category as would someone who's got chest pain or who's in cardiac arrest. And it all basically comes down to money, because I think the only way to really get around that would be to put really medically trained people on the phones to actually sit there and assess the situation and put them in a more appropriate priority level.
Well, I'm not gonna dog the Clausen system, because I think it actually works pretty well. Because I think that most of those cards are designed to weed that out. Now, you we'll get the people that know how to game the system, and that's always hard in any structure of a system, no matter what you do. Even as an EMT and a paramedic, you get the people that know how to game you and make you think that they have one problem when they really just need a ride to X or whatever. I mean, that's going to happen all the time. I don't think that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. I think that it's... Well, I think that there are problems with Claussen, and it has its issues and things like that. I think that the Claussen dispatch system, by and large, has proven to work, and it does, for the most part, dispatch the appropriate unit at the appropriate response most of the time. And, you know, again, there are going to be those times when it happens that you get priority one or you get downgraded when you should have been upgraded. That's inherent in anytime you're dealing with people, that's going to happen. Now, if we could just plug this all into a computer and people are computers and you knew exactly what the problem was, it'd be a lot easier to triage that situation.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's fine.
I was just saying it kind of brought up an interesting thing that the city of Toronto did, which they presented on, I think it was at one or two NAMSP meetings ago, where they took their dispatch indicators and looked at the most frequent ones and actually were able to tie in their EPCR system to their CAD and figure out, well, okay, yeah, it was this indicator, what percentage of the time did we utilize advanced life support resources, or, you know, and what types of resources? You know, was it a full resuscitation? Was it we just started a precautionary IV? Was it a BLS move in? And they were able to kind of tailor their system a little bit, which Claussen allows you to do, and optimize a little bit more their responses. Now, not every system is busy enough like the city of Toronto to really get good numbers, but your point brought up that interesting presentation I saw.
Well, I said, go ahead, Sean.
My service does something similar to that. We recently started doing a study on a percentage of patients that we dispatch priority two or priority one actually get transported priority four, which would be with BLS interventions, or vice versa. You know, how many priority three calls end up getting transported with lights and sirens, or getting if a BLS unit responds, you know, how many of those actually end up getting turfed to ALS? And I think it's going to be really interesting to see the results of that outcome. Give us a better idea on how effective our dispatch system really is.
Well, and again, you can't model every patient every time, but you can get close, and I think that that's what's important. And I think that that also will help your system administrators go, gee, we do need more ALS trucks, or boy, we could, you know, we can cut back ALS at this time and have more BLS at this time and really look at your system your system as a whole, and how do you provide the quickest, best care? Now, I hesitate because I really want to get back to this idea of, is response time important, and does it matter? And I want to hear some thoughts on that. I mean, from the patient perspective and from the medical perspective, you know, is a 6-minute response time important when they're going to go sit in the ER 40 minutes before they see a doctor?
From the patient point of view, absolutely. They want somebody there them being and, you know, again, you know, I've had patients say that, listen, wow, you guys got here quick. And that's what I think is the important part.
I think it has to do with how the patients view their EMS system, too. I think someone who lives in the city has an expectation that the ambulance is going to get there in 6 minutes. I can tell you in our area that they're really happy if we can get there within a half hour. It's kind of a standing joke that we have same-day service. And in some of our areas, that's what we have, is same-day service. Depending on how quickly we can get there, it's going to really depend on logistics. So I think it is also a culture within your area. I think more in the lower 48, they have the expectation that you're going to get there. When I call, you get here in 5 minutes or else.
It's a little less like that.
Yeah.
I, I agree that with the on a patient's perspective, it does matter, but on a medical perspective, there's only a very small percentage of calls that where it actually does matter, because I mean, if I can count on one hand the amount of times I run a call that I would deem to be a legitimate emergency call in the course of a month, it's kind of hard to justify showing up to every single call within 8 minutes. But I really think it kind of goes back to dispatch and being able to properly triage these people and put a priority on them.
Right. Well, I think that's what it's about, really, too, and in how we look at our response time. Now, how about this, Kyle? Let me throw something at you. What if you call 911 today and you say, "I have X problem," and the dispatcher comes back and says, "Okay, we understand that, and we are triaging you to a 20-minute response. You will have an ambulance to your location in 20 minutes." Now, if the patient knew that up front, is that meeting the patient's expectation and need?
What happens when you go to the local fast food chain and you see 6 cars in front of you at the drive-in window? What do you do?
Go inside.
So you go yourself.
Actually, you know what? There actually is science behind that. If there are 5 people in front of you in the drive-up lane, go inside because the line's shorter. Sorry, I read that somewhere. I'm nerdy enough to remember that.
I think that's a good analogy, because when you say you would go inside, well, I think a lot of people might drive themselves to the hospital.
And there you go. Then they didn't need the response to begin with, did they? And I think that that's really what this goes back to is, okay, so let's pull some calls out of the EMS system. We go on things all the time that if the Alpha and the Bravo and the Omega calls were said, hey, you're going to get this dispatch, you're going to get an ambulance within the next X amount of time. And we set a criteria for that. Most patients would go, I'm gonna go to the urgent care facility, or, you know, it just isn't that bad. I'll go see my physician in the morning. And there you go. Then, you know, they say, hey, if it gets worse, call us back. We'll be there, you know, whatever. Then you've set up a proper expectation for our society versus this idea that, I know if I call 911 now, they'll be here in 5 minutes, they'll help me out, and, you know, no matter what my problem is, whether I have gas pain at 2 a.m. or I have, you know, it's bad chili or whatever the case may be, I think as a society in EMS have built ourselves up a little bit too much.
Chris, I mean, don't you think, I mean, anecdotally, I can't say this to any, you know, research, as I always get yelled at by the docs, I almost think that the people who need the ambulance the most, especially the elderly, are more likely to drive themselves to the hospital. And sometimes, I had a lady just arrived at the hospital the other day with a broken pelvis. She didn't want to bother us. And,
yeah,
you know, you get the younger folks,
that.
You know, with the earache, they want the ambulance now because they don't have a way to get in.
We need to look at our EMS system not as a public safety model, not in the public safety model that we've all grown up in, but in the public health model, because there's you know, everybody has had a number of suggestions on alternate ways to get patients medical care. You know, in some cases, yeah, it's a transportation issue, and the person is calling 911 because of a transportation issue. Maybe it's a pride and education issue, and like my neighbor drives, he has his wife drive himself to the hospital when he has an acute stroke. You know, maybe it's just not knowing who to call. And if we step back for a second and look at it as a total healthcare package, you know, then maybe we can better treat some of these people, get them the help that they need, and you know, really be able to fine tune where we need to speed.
Well, and I hate to, again, I'm playing devil's advocate for a lot of this, so trust me, I'm take what I say with a grain of salt because I don't obviously believe everything I say. But Kyle, what was the negative outcome of the lady that drove herself in with a broken hip? What was the negative outcome of the woman that recognized her husband had a stroke and drove him in?
If we weren't able to get out of the car, I think there would have been an issue because the hospital staff had no idea how to get her out of the car.
Okay. But you... Okay. At the hospital. But I'm just saying that there were no negative outcomes because that patient had to wait.
Well, if you look at, I believe it's a Toronto study, they said that ALS is actually detrimental to cardiac patients.
Well, I would probably agree with that.
Yeah, if you want to go down to it, is there really any, does EMS, is EMS effective at all?
Yeah, that's a bigger topic than this podcast can cover tonight. But I do agree that I like playing that devil's advocate from time to time because I think that we have grown up in the system where people were dying in ditches in 1968, and that's why we built the system. Well, the system has changed. We've become more sophisticated. We're better healthcare providers, but the system that it was built on has never changed because of that. The ideas and the tenements that we built the system around didn't progress with time, even though the education and the ability to move patients and the ability to take care of people in their homes, a la community paramedic, paramedic practitioner, whatever flavor you want to call that, really we haven't taken that for what we could. And I guess it just annoys me a little bit that we were stuck in this thing of response time is the most important thing ever, and it's not. It's meaningless. And for 98% of the patients out there, I would say it's the most meaningless thing other than their expectation than anything else. And if we change their expectation and change their view of it, maybe we could actually start making some inroads into helping people where they live and keeping them where they live and saying, you know what? You're right. You probably do have an earache. We're going to come out and we'll have a paramedic there within the next hour. He'll be able to examine you. He'll be able to use an otoscope and determine that you do probably have an ear infection and probably a sinus infection to go along with it. And he'll be able to prescribe antibiotics for you, leave you at home, and have a good night and give you a couple samples and you see your physician follow up in the next day. Man, what a great system that would be.
Isn't that community paramedic?
More than community paramedic. That's actually what I would kind of call a paramedic practitioner.
Practitioner, yes.
The nursing industry, I hear the helicopters of the nurses above me right now because they're coming after me as I speak. But you know what? They don't want to do it. The other industries don't want to do this. And here's the other piece of this. We tried it in our state. Our state medical director, I went and sat down with him a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, we tried what you're trying. We put PAs in the ambulance, and they would go out, and we called it a mobile urgent care. And they'd go out and take care of things in this private service he's working for. And he goes, you know why the private service shut it down? I said, I know why, because you couldn't get a dollar for it. And he goes, yep. And I said, well, but that's not what this is about. It's about communities that really care about patients and care about community health and want to see patients survive at home and live at home and be able to do all those things when the physician practices can't take them or they can't pay for the service or X, Y, and Z. That's what this system's about. It's about taking healthcare to people. And I'm sure I'll die on this one, but really, it's about us being the last mobile healthcare entity in the world that can provide healthcare at the patient's bedside 24/7, 365, whenever you call. And that's what we should be about. We shouldn't be about saving people from cardiac arrest, which is important. Don't get me wrong. That's important. We shouldn't be about the golden hour, which is bunk. We shouldn't be about all the plethora of other things that our industry was built on in 1968 because it's bunk. It's bogus. We've proven that it's wrong. And now it's time that we as an industry stand up and say it, which goes back to education and everything else we've talked about. But really, it's time that we stand up and say, we want to be healthcare, and here's how we do it.
You know, you were talking a few minutes ago about people's expectations, and there was one thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, at least in some of the area where I work, and I've worked 911 in a couple of little communities and things like that, I found that, you know, the usual expectation is if I drive myself to the ER, I'm going to have to sit in the waiting room for 45 minutes, and I may or may not see a doctor in the urgent care center. It may just be a PA. But if I call the ambulance, someone will come over, pick me up, take me there. I'll go straight back to the ER, see a doctor right away. And you know what? I'll go to the county hospital. That way I don't have to pay for it. And so the expectation there can be really variable, I think, when we're talking about what a patient's looking for when they call 911.
I got to tell you, I've had people tell me that all the time. Well, if I go by the ambulance, I get in faster. And I actually look at them and say, not necessarily. They take, you know, the patient based on how sick they are, how well they don't feel, and what's wrong with them. And just because you come in by ambulance doesn't mean you're going to get in back faster. And I've had people turn around and go, really? Well, I guess I'll go by car.
And you know,
we triage people to the waiting room right off the stretcher if they're low acuity.
And, you know, I actually agree with that 100%, but it's all about that perception when they call 911 that they feel like they're going to get faster service at the emergency room by calling 911, even though they may not necessarily get it. That's the way that they feel when they call. At least that's kind of what I have seen.
Well, I mean, it's definitely hard to get, you know, we have the issue, too, where we have crews in the hallways. You can't send, you know, the person who's getting monitored or the person with trouble breathing out to the waiting room. Unfortunately, we get hit with a lot of those at times, but we do try to do that when we can. I don't know if it's changing public perception, but
I know up here we have a system. The native healthcare system allows for medevacs out of the villages. For those of you who aren't as familiar with Alaska, if you wanted to look at the EMS system, you could take Texas and wipe out all of their roads, put a hospital at the northern end, and then tell everybody else that they're going to have to somehow get to that one hospital. That would describe Fairbanks. We have no roads north of us, and it's about a 500 miles straight up. But all of those communities use an airplane, a fixed-wing airplane, to get in. The Tanana Chiefs, which is the Native Health Corporation, pays. They pay for all of the medical transport out of the villages. And it didn't take long for people to figure out that if you called and said you were really, really sick, an airplane would arrive and you could go to town. And then when you got to town, you could go do what you needed to do, shopping or whatever, and then come back home. So they actually had to put in a triage, per se, that a medical doctor actually had to be the one that made the decision as to whether or not you really needed an air ambulance now, or you could wait until the next flight came in tomorrow and come in on the regular flight to see the doc. And it significantly decreased the amount of people that were calling, I need to be flown out, because they had to explain, you know, exactly what was going on. A health aide had to look at them before they actually made that transport. The same thing happens with ambulances. We do get a lot of people who just call up and say they just want to head to town. When you're 50 miles out, if you dial 911, an ambulance will come and get you and bring you to town, and then you can take, and what's even worse is if you're really, really sick, we'll even take you back home.
the abuses of the system just come here. And yeah, let's see. I have a feeling every February I'm kind of feeling blue, and I need to get out of Vail. So is there any way that they could fly me to the Bahamas, because I just need some sun and beach time? Because that would be great.
I've actually responded into a community where the whole family had their suitcases waiting for us.
The positive Samsonite sign. That's always a good sign with a patient, yes.
It always makes you feel good when you walk in the door.
I got a question for Wilma. Is it true that the population of bears in Alaska exceeds the population of humans?
That could very well be. I don't know statistically, but we only have, let's just tell you, the population of Alaska is about 600,000. We have 600,000 square miles, so we have one person per square mile if you were to stick us all in our own little spot. Most of the population is in Anchorage. 350,000 of them are in the Anchorage Bowl. So a good, all the rest of us are kind of out there in the rural areas.
And what's pretty funny is you have the same population as the state of Wyoming and several other states, and you jam-pack them into a huge area. And I think people often don't realize how big Alaska is. Take it and stick it over the United States, continental United States, and they don't realize how big it is, especially with the outer islands and everything. It's pretty big.
We completely cover the United States if you count the outer islands. But yep. To give people an idea of how big we are, if you were to take the state of Texas and or take Alaska and cut us in half, we would make Texas the third largest state. We are more than twice the size of Texas.
Nice. See, and they always think things are bigger in Texas, right, James?
Yeah.
Easy there.
No, we just got to... Hey, it's nice when we have the Texan and the Alaskan on. We get to see who thinks that their state's
bigger. We do like to compete.
As one of my colleagues says, but Texas was its own country, though, at one point in time.
That's very true. That's very true. They don't call it the Lone Star State for nothing.
I'll be in Texas next week, so... I won't exactly be escaping the heat as I had originally planned, but
yeah, it's hot.
Sure, we'll be having a good time. Yeah.
Don't come down here if you want to escape heat; it doesn't work.
I'll be up in the Fort Worth area.
I was going to say you can definitely come to Alaska and escape the heat.
I was going to say go north; it's much better.
Yeah. Don't come to Buffalo; we're pretty hot.
It's what, 92 today?
Yeah.
Goodness. Well, I don't think we have time for the next topic, which I really wanted to talk about, which was ER docs receiving care and on-scene training. Maybe we can hit that up next time. But it was a very lively discussion tonight. I guess a couple of points that I wanted to make after we had kind of gone through all of this, that I think that you just need to examine your system for what it is, and you need to know what's important to your system. Is spending $500,000 to predict where the next call is going to be really the best thing? I'm sure you could probably write a grant and get an administrator to think that that's appropriate, but man, I just have to think that there's something better out there for our systems in general. And the people that write these programs are very smart, and they've done a lot of work in the... given the types of models they're doing, and I saw some stuff at the EMS Today show that was really very cool. In fact, the gentleman that was standing across from us had one of these programs that, you know, showed where all the ambulances were and their projected coverage area while they were in that, and you know, was really showing off the latest and greatest in statistical modeling for EMS calls. You know, I don't think it's exactly a true science, which is good. So I think that there's some room for improvement. And I think that we as an industry, people hate change in our industry more than anything else. And so to get something new and exciting and that maybe will make a difference someday takes some visionaries and takes some people that will take some risks. And you know what? It took a couple hundred light bulbs to make until they got the right one, and Edison didn't know that when he started the project. I guarantee you, I'm not going to do that. That looks really too hard. But it takes people that have vision to work on it and maybe fail a little bit, retool it, and go back and try it again. And maybe that's what we'll learn from this is maybe we'll be able to design that. But then we also need to look at our industry as a whole and how can we make it better. So I don't know, James, you got to get us down to the Texas EMS conference. That's what I'm thinking. I love you guys have a huge show down there, and I think it'd be a lot of fun. So I diverged because I was thinking of that at the same time. So yeah, you can get us down there.
I'll have to see what I can do. I don't know offhand.
Right on. Well, we'll try. That'd be cool. Well, thank you guys so much. Dr. Jeff Myers, do you have a blog or a Twitter? Do you do anything like that?
I wish I had time. I really do. And especially because I just see so many amusing things in the emergency department. But I do have a website that has some of my talks on it, which hopefully get a little bit of time to make that a little more robust.
Very cool. Well, can people contact you, or do you want to just remain nearly Dr. Anonymous? That title's already taken, by the way.
That would be fine. It's ems-ed.photoemsdoc.com, And there's a contact email button on there. And I welcome welcome any conversation.
Cool. And I will have I'll stick that URL in the show notes, so I'll get that here in a little bit. Well, thank you, Dr. Myers. I really appreciate it tonight. Miss... All right on. Well, Miss Wilma Vinton, you're going to invite us all up to the Alaska EMS conference, I hope, too. That would be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. We have a conference every April. In the state conferences in November, which we've invited Kyle to come up and speak to this fall, which I'm excited about. And then I am with Interior Region. I'm with Interior Region EMS Council. Most of the states have an EMS organization at the state level that does all their certifications and everything, but Alaska's too big, so they divided it up into seven regions, and I work with one of those regions that does all the certification and EMS training and instructor training and stuff. And you can find our website at iremsc.org, www.iremsc.org.
Very cool. We'll figure out a way to get EMS Garage up there. We'd love to highlight Alaska and get a trip out of it as well. So just remember
that.
I'm just trying to pimp us out a little bit.
Yeah. There you go.
Road trip.
Some of the response areas would surprise you. I took Kyle out to the farthest area that we go to, and that was a education for him.
Yeah, I bet. Although he's seen a lot, so I actually knew a medic that used to fly up in, I'll never remember, it's somewhere near Nome out there. She was up there for a couple of years and seemed to like it.
Then, of you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Of you. Mm-hmm, it's a beautiful area.
It is, and she'd send me pictures. I was like, oh, it looks really cool. And then they said that they had red jumpsuits, and I said, well, that would be kind of inconvenient if there are polar bears nearby, because how would you tell that between what the polar bears had ripped up? But anyway, that's beside the point.
Red's important. You know why they have red jumpsuits?
No.
To find them if the plane goes down.
Well, that's what I would assume. I would assume Dale Glow Green would work
out
better.
Would be even better, yes.
I would think of no matter what jumpsuit you're wearing, it would end up red anyways if you went down.
Yeah.
Sorry.
or very black.
No. Depends on the size of the airplane. Some of them float quite nicely.
It's kind of like having clean underwear in case you get hit by a bus.
Yeah.
Well, it was clean. That's right. Well, thank you for joining us, Wilma. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Sean Eddy, where can people find you?
As usual, you can find me on my website, medicmadness.com. You can also find me on Twitter, at Sean Eddy. Various other places, if you go to my website, I have contact information there.
Very cool. Well, thank you. Mr. James Wormuth, am I saying your last name right? James, hello.
I think. Sorry about that.
No problem. You were on mute.
I got buried in the chat room and I couldn't get over to unmute the mic.
We've never done that before on this show ever, right, Kyle?
Oh yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. No, it's James. Am I saying your last name right?
It's close enough. I can go with that.
No, tell me how to say it, because I'll mispronounce it 20 times.
It's Wormuth.
Wormuth. There you go. Okay.
There you go.
So it's less on the U. Got it. Okay, Wormuth. And where can people find you?
They can't find me anywhere, I'll be honest. I've got a Twitter account that I am very ashamed of. I've had it for like 3 months and haven't put a single post in it. I would be happy to share it once I actually put something up.
You know, actually, that was my experience with Twitter when I first got on. I got on Twitter about a month after it started. And I was like, what's the point? It's kind of weird. And now I actually use it a lot more. So it takes time. And I still don't use it to its fullest potential. I know people are on it all day. And if I do about 4 posts a week, I'm pretty happy. So, yeah, I understand. And I completely feel your pain. There's just no time, like Dr. Myers said. But, you know, people want to feel like they're connected. Mr. Kyle David Bates, where can people find you, sir?
Many places. KyleDavidBates.com, Twitter at ImageMedic. You can also go to our new podcast at FirstFewMoments.com, Managing the Scene, dealing with
safety management, triage and care of motor vehicle crashes and lively discussions that we're having there. We just finished recording our third episode just before this one.
Yes, it was very good, and I liked it. That kind of and it drove us off into a tangent, as always. Sorry about that.
Yeah,
but it was good. It was good. It was a lot of fun.
You can also find me at the NEMZ Conference Symposium in Schaumburg, Illinois, and EMS Expo.
Very cool. My training captain's going, so I'll tell her to look you up.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Yeah. She was, I sent her the link a couple weeks ago. She goes, you know, I already registered. I'm like, no, sorry. She came in and hit me over the head. Anyway, well, thank you guys for joining us. I will put in one plug for Miss P and Miss Paramedic down there in Louisiana. She had to hop off. Apparently, they had a long day and they wanted to make dinner or whatever. Her and Germedic. And I really think it's a Twit Mance, but or Chronicles of EMS Mance. I don't know which, but don't tell them I told you that. Well, okay, maybe if you heard it on here, then it must be true. Well, and as always, I'm Geeky Medic on all the websites. Join us next time when we talk more about issues that concern you in EMS. And have a great week. Go out and enjoy the sun, or stay inside and keep cool wherever you're at. Sure, it'll be fun. Thanks a lot.